It is 6:14, first day of October. There's a little bit of weather in the Gulf. Might cause some rain for us later in the week. Honestly, they don't know. I don't know what to tell you because they don't know. They don't know. I think it's one of these things where maybe back in the day when we didn't have all of this technology, maybe we wouldn't have even known about it. So maybe we wouldn't have even had to worry about it. Or maybe we don't have to worry about it now. Again, they don't know. So I don't know what to tell you other than it might rain later on in the week and then maybe on later on this weekend. A couple of stories in the Atlantic this month, I guess it comes out, hypocrisy, spinelessness, and the triumph of Donald Trump. Does not blast Donald Trump. What that does is it talks about so many Republicans that were never Trumpers that completely flipped. And if you read the story, you'll see quotes from Donald Trump, how he makes fun of them for doing that, how he predicted this in 2016, how he was going to bring the Republican Party to its knees, how they were going to cower to him, and that's exactly what happened. That being said, the vice presidential debate is tonight. One of the people taking part in it is J.D. Vance, his vice presidential candidate, candidate who was a never-Trumper at one point. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University. How you doing, David?
I am doing great, and I hope you're doing well.
I'm well. Did you read that story or not in The Atlantic?
I did read that story. Yes, I did. And it seems to me that one of the if what truth is the first casualty of politics, I guess the second casualty is probably what consistency or something like that. And it just seems like maybe it's worse now than it used to be. I don't know. You know, but the fact that you have people like, you know, you have Vance, you have Haley, you know, who during the primary, you know, basically, you know, hammered Trump about being what, unqualified, et cetera, et cetera. Vance did the same thing. And then you have people, take us back, 4 years ago, you have Mitch McConnell during the second impeachment trial, you know, who is strongly critical also of Trump. And then all these people line up right behind him.
Lindsey Graham, if I can phrase this delicately, if Trump were to ever stop short, Lindsey Graham would disappear. If you get my meaning on that.
I do.
Okay.
I do.
Because, and Trump, to his credit, he predicted this back in 2016 that he would have these people cowering to him and kissing his ring or anything else. And he's even called these politicians out on stage and said, I think it was Lindsey Graham, I don't want to misquote anything from the article here, but that he wants my nomination or he wants a nomination, so he's kissing my A. On stage, he says this about these people in front of him, and they continue to kiss his A, which is interesting. Let's talk about the vice presidential debate tonight. Some people are saying it matters. Some people say it doesn't. Your thoughts?
For the most part, vice presidential debates really don't matter at the end of the day. Again, people are voting for the president of the United States. And generally, again, like I said, they don't matter. The first rule of vice presidential debates is do no harm. Don't make any major mistakes, of which now, tomorrow in tomorrow's paper, they'll be highlighting that. And of course, if you think of major mistakes in terms of president or vice presidential debates, you have to go back 30 years ago to Dan Quayle, Lloyd Benson, with Quayle comparing himself to JFK and Benson just flattening him, you know, on that. So first, make no mistake. And then two, at that point, it's what? Defend your president, make the points you want to make, try to humiliate the other side. But generally, they don't matter. But maybe, just maybe this year, in an election so close where moving 1,000 people here, 1,000 people there might matter, maybe it matters a little bit, but it'll mostly be, I don't know, maybe a good show just to watch tonight. You know, it's like entertainment, I'll call it. Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me. It seems like a what do you call them? What's the new thing? WWE? Is that wrestling? What is the new wrestling federation?
Yeah. Is that World Wrestling Federation? Yeah. Something? I can't remember. WWF, something like that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me, where it's going to be interesting to watch. Maybe it's real, you know, maybe it's not, but I don't think it's going to change one mind at all. I really don't. I guess you could look at it from the standpoint of one of these people could wind up being president. You never know. Actuarially speaking, you would think that would mean that Vance would have a better, and again, this is nothing to do with partisanship or anything else. It's just insurance companies and age and actuarial tables that you would think it would be more of a concern when you talk about Vance or Trump, but I don't think people are going to make that connection. Do you?
I don't think so either. I mean, possibly if it was still Biden versus Trump, you know, maybe given the fact that an 82-year-old versus a 78-year-old, maybe it would have been on more people's minds. But I really just don't think so. I also don't think tonight we're going to hear very much in terms of serious depth or policy. That there'll be probably the two or three talking points that each side wants to make, and then there'll be the two or three talking points they want to use to attack the other side. And I think really the question that we're going to look to see tonight is if and how quickly does it degenerate into personal attacks? Because I think that's what a lot of people are expecting at this point, is that it's going to turn ugly. If it helps at all, you know, because Waltz is the governor of Minnesota where I live. The last debate that he did when he was running for governor against Dr. Jensen, I was a medical doctor a couple of years ago, was incredibly ugly. I mean, within minutes, it was just flinging insults back and forth. And so
Waltz?
Waltz, yeah. Who's my governor, right, in Minnesota. So listen and remember, I know a lot about Waltz, you know, because he's my governor for the last 6 years. And Vance is known for also being able to, you know, to fling insults. And so going back to the wrestling, I guess, parallel here, you know, how quickly before, I don't know, somebody, you know, I'm trying to say, I'm not a wrestling fan myself, but how quickly before somebody throws somebody else on the mat or whatever like that? That's what I'm sort of wondering tonight.
A metal folding chair comes out of nowhere and slaps somebody, all of a sudden Donald Trump appears. He appears in the wings and rips off his jacket and shows his muscular frame and then starts throwing punches. And then maybe I'm getting a little carried away here, but anyway, let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking about the vice presidential debate, which is going to be a show, I think. And I don't know if anybody's going to change your mind. One thing we'll talk about is military records when we come back. And my military record is better than yours, or I'm more of a soldier than you are. We'll talk about that as well. 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to David Schultz, our friend, professor of political science at Hamline University, about the presidential race and the vice presidential debate that's going to happen tonight. Caroline Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani's daughter, endorsed Kamala Harris. She says, Donald Trump took my dad from me. Please don't let him take our country, too. Who knows what's going on with the family dynamic there? But the question I want to know, asking you, David, is, do endorsements matter, whether they come from within the family, outside of the family, within the party, outside of the party?
Now, the evidence is, if we look at it over time, like if we're talking about celebrity endorsements or any type of endorsements, probably marginal at best. You know, that is, and I'm going to say, even if they did in the past, this election, I don't think they matter whatsoever. That the electorate is so polarized, so locked into what their preferences are at this point. One of the things that's been really fascinating this year is people kept looking for all these so-called bumps. A convention bump, or an assassination bump, or debate bump, and there's been no real meaningful bumps whatsoever. And I just think it's because people have been so locked into their views at this point that there's practically nobody to persuade or move at this point. And it's really just going to come down to, you know, who gets off their butt or off the couch, you know, on election day and shows up to vote. You know, but in terms of, do you know anybody who's truly saying, gosh, I don't know if I'm going to vote for Trump or Harris. I'm truly undecided at this point. I don't know either. Minds are made up at this point. It's just like I said, are they going to get up and go out and vote at this point?
There's no exit polling on early voting or anything like that, right? So we have no idea what's going on with early voting?
We don't at this point. We know it's taking place in several states. We don't have any really good indication at this point at how heavy it is. Now, clearly 4 years ago, we were in the middle of the pandemic and it was incredibly heavy. But here we just don't have an indication on it. But you're raising, I want to bring up an interesting point here, is that looking at one of the so-called swing states this year is North Carolina. And as we know, unfortunately, we have, you know, parts of North Carolina, you know, the western parts were just devastated by the hurricane. And the question now becomes, what impact might that hurricane have in terms of voting? Because that's also areas of the country which are more likely to vote Republican. So this the hurricane, you know, 30 days down the line here, and we still have to go before the election, could have an impact on that state and on that election.
You know, and again, I'm seeing different things about the response, and Trump saying one thing, the White House saying the other thing, and I got to believe that the White, and I'm not, look, taking sides here, but I got to believe that the White House would be woefully negligent, is considering it's North Carolina, not to give every bit of help that they could to whatever state needed it, depending upon, you know, if the right declarations were made and the right request and the right paperwork was filled in and all of that stuff. So, again, does that change anything, or does everybody believe what they want about that, about the response?
Everybody's going to believe what they want to believe at this point. I mean, there just seems to be nothing that's moving anybody at this point. And if I am like a television station at this point in one of the swing states, I'm thrilled to death, you know, that people have dumped in hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, in advertising, you know, that I can, so basically our revenue goes up for the year. But at some point, the advertising also is wasted. It's like carpet bombing in the States. It's saturation. Again, I don't think it's changing anybody, people's minds. One of my friends in Pennsylvania said to me, he'll be thrilled to see a car ad on television again after Election Day. And if you sort of get the drift of where he's going at this point, he's just like, I've made up my mind. I don't need to see any more ads.
Does there ever come a point where it is a negative, where people say, that's it, if I hear, and I get that way sometimes in local elections, yeah, where I say to myself, I swear to God, if I hear one more election, if I get one more text, I'm not going to vote for you.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the issue at this point. If, given the fact they're so negative and each side is attacking the other, it might take those few undecided voters that are out there and just say, well, the heck with both of you, I'm just not going to vote for anybody on Election Day.
All right, thanks. I appreciate your time, David. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Jan Moeller about the looming budget deficit. Right now, time for WWL First News. 644, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Jan Moeller joins us now, Executive Director of Investland Louisiana. Good morning, Jan. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning to you, Tommy.
Somebody texted in and said, a flat tax is the way to go. The more you spend, the more you pay in taxes. The less you spend, the less you pay in taxes. Can't get any more fair than that. That's what that person from the last four digits of 9418 thinks. Thoughts?
Well, if you pass a flat tax in Louisiana, and I think that's what Governor Landry is going to propose, it comes at a huge cost to state government. We estimate that it would cost about $1.1 billion in lost revenue. So if you want to have a flat tax, Tommy, then you're also going to have a lot of cuts to the budget. And we're already starting to see, because the legislature is already having hearings on the budget, what those would look like. And there's talk about closing campuses in the community and technical college system. There's talk of health care cuts. There's talk of all kinds of programs and services that I think people expect state government to provide, which they wouldn't be able to provide. So I think a flat tax sounds great to a lot of people, but it comes at a huge cost to the services that people expect.
Well, the texter said the more you spend, the more you pay in taxes, but the flat tax, he's talking about a flat income tax, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it has nothing to do with spending. The state has a personal income tax. 42 states have a personal income tax. Some states don't, of course. We always hear about Florida and Texas. But yeah, you pay a percentage of your income to the state. And the way Louisiana and most states do it, that income tax is progressive. So you pay a low rate on the first, say, $12,000, $15,000 you make, then you pay another rate on as your income goes up, and then you pay a top rate on your highest income. So it only applies to income above a certain level. That's called a progressive tax system. That's what we have in Louisiana, although ours isn't very high. We have very low income taxes overall. But what I think the governor is going to propose maybe this week, you know, we haven't seen his exact plan. We've seen some PowerPoints and ideas thrown out there, is to lower personal income taxes even more. And I think people have to understand Louisiana's income taxes are already among the lowest in the entire country, among the states that have a personal income tax. So if you want to go with a flat tax, what you're talking about is taking one of the lowest income taxes in the country, making it even lower, And then as a consequence, you either have to raise taxes somewhere else. And I think the governor's going to propose sales taxes going up, where Louisiana is already the highest in the country, one of the highest in the entire country. And if you're not going to be willing to raise taxes somewhere else, then you're really looking at deep cuts to the state budget.
So when it comes to this flat tax that you're expecting the governor to propose, who would benefit most? Who would get hurt the most?
It's easy. The people at the very top, the wealthiest Louisianans, and I think in the top 1%, you have to have a net taxable income of more than $683,000. The average income of people in the top 1% is about $1.1 million. If you're in that top 1%, the flat tax proposal that's out there would save you about $10,000 a year in state income taxes. If you're somewhere in the middle, you might save about $200, $250 a year. So I think everybody would save a little bit under this proposal. And so I think it sounds great to a lot of people, but I think you also have to calculate what services are you going to lose and what taxes are going to go up somewhere else. You know, when people raise the sales tax, for example, you don't notice it in the same way you notice the income tax because you pay it every time you buy something. So that's that. Again, we haven't seen the governor's plan yet. We're waiting to see that. It could come out as early as today. We know the governor has been talking to legislators, talking to people. His revenue secretary has been out and about the state talking about this idea, but we haven't seen a concrete plan. We haven't really seen yet how the numbers are going to. And so it's going to be a key thing for us to see. And really, I think a lot of legislators are going to want to see that before they decide whether this is something they want to sign on to and whether they want to meet in a special session. Of course, you probably heard the governor's plan as of now is for to have the legislature come in after the November 5th election, but before Thanksgiving in a special session to do a lot of these things. For some reason, he wants to get this done in November instead of waiting for the regular session that's happening in April.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Investland Louisiana, about this fiscal cliff. We'll talk about what's leading to that and again, what can be cut, what can't be cut, what it's likely to look like if it goes through. Somebody texted in and said, stop the wasteful spending. And we'll talk about that as well, Jan, about where budget cuts can be made, where they can't, and what's going to be hurt, et cetera. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:55, 5 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking about the looming fiscal cliff. Somebody texted in and said, why is it that it's always the citizens that have to adjust their spending, but then the government never has to adjust their spending to make ends meet? I think the corollary to that text is, while inflation affects everybody, it also affects government spending as well. And that brings us, Jan Moeller, I guess, Executive Director of Louisiana, of Invest in Louisiana, to when it comes to cutting government spending and the Louisiana Constitution and flat tax and what's likely to be hurt, what they can cut and what they can't, right?
Absolutely. And look, state government is not like the federal government, where if you take in less revenue than you need to run the government, you just put it all on the credit card. The state can't run deficits, so the state has to balance its budget every year. Every budget that comes out of Baton Rouge in June is balanced against the revenue that's coming in. The problem is the legislature, you know, created this fiscal cliff because they can't seem to agree on a tax structure for very long. So the legislature created this problem for itself. And frankly, it's not Jeff Landry's fault. Jeff Landry didn't create this problem. The legislature created it in 2018 when they passed a tax package that had some temporary taxes on the books, a temporary sales tax, a temporary tax on business utilities. And they made the decision to shift some dollars out of the state general fund that's going to go into the transportation trust fund. You put those three, you know, tax cuts that are taking effect next year together, you get about a little over $500 million shortfall. And that's what's causing the budget to have to be cut. And the way that we've structured the budget is there's a lot of money that's locked away in the Constitution, or money that you kind of, even if it's not locked in the Constitution, it's money you have to spend. For example, corrections. If you're going to put somebody in jail, it costs a certain amount of money to guard them and feed them and keep the lights on in the prisons. So that's considered kind of non-discretionary money. When you take all that off the table, that leaves you with health care, education, and social services. And so that's where the cuts come. And on the education side, it's really mostly in higher education, because the money we spend on public schools is part of those constitutional dedications. So that's why you very quickly start looking at these services that serve people with very low incomes, medically fragile children, and higher education in particular. And when we're talking about cuts to higher education, readers have to understand colleges, when they get cut by the state, they just raise tuition and fees. So what you're really talking about there is pushing costs onto students and families for people who just want to go to college, get an education, or maybe get a certificate so they can go work somewhere.
So Richard Nelson and the governor say this is the way to go, that it's going to attract more business to Louisiana, and as a result, it's going to attract more jobs. What do you say to that?
Well, that's the theory, at least. If having low taxes was the key to bringing business in, we'd already have all the business we need, because Louisiana is already a pretty low tax state. So I think, the other side of that coin is you bring in business and you attract people when you have an educated workforce, when you have good schools, when you have good roads and infrastructure. And so there's only so much the tax cuts can do. At some point, you have to invest in your people. And then that's, I think, what's going to bring people in and make Louisiana the kind of place where people want to move.
Thank you, Jan. Appreciate your time and your insights, as always. Wanted to get the other side of things. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to the principal deputy director of the CDC about respiratory viruses. Always a serious concern. We'll tell you what you need to know, what you need to know to keep you and your family safe. Then we'll talk to Ollie Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans, and recap Pelicans Media Day. And, of course, the Pelicans games will be here on WWL. Back in a little bit.